several powers at once. So you're the kind of people attracted to it tend to be a little bit nutty. And they like to spy on people. They like to play a double role. They're a little bit loony, and it makes them very. It makes it very hard to control them. As long as the mere existence of some congressional supervisory committee is not going to be enough to cut it off. And these problems are very, very difficult because, as I was saying earlier, the intelligence miasma in our society arises out of fear of danger to property rights. And in the foreign field, that is the source of the CIA. And the CIA, too, has its genealogy. You know, these dirty tricks by which we overthrow foreign leaders, put in dictators, get people bumped off, are an old story. Our country, unfortunately, while a democracy at home, has pursued imperialist policies abroad for quite a long time. Although most Americans are completely unaware of what we've done in Latin America. And there, State Department agents and the US Marines in Haiti and Cuba and Dominican Republic and Nicaragua, Honduras and Panama have did on a smaller scale all the things that the CIA has been doing in Iran and in Chile and in Guatemala and elsewhere. And the CIA is merely the institutionalization on a huge scale of the kind of practices that we carried on under the rubric of dollar diplomacy and Yankee imperialism before the First World War in Latin America. And it brings us to one of the basic problems we confront, and that is it's very hard to run an empire abroad and maintain a free society at home. You know, at the end of the Spanish-American War, when we moved to annex the Philippines, an anti-imperialist league was formed in our country. It was one time when Americans were not afraid to use plain language, and two living presidents joined that league, Grover Cleveland and Benjamin Harrison. And they warned that if we annexed the Philippines, it would be the beginning of an American empire, and the existence of empire would poison a democracy. And unfortunately, their warnings were unavailing. But when you have a vast investments abroad, as we do, as our great corporations and banks do, in copper, in sugar, in fruit, in corporations and multinationals, these are tremendous national interests, which demand to be protected. And they're fearful of reform governments that might shear away their privileges. And this is how State Department imperialism began in Latin America, and this is how it advances in the world today. And in addition, when you have two great empires in the world, the Soviet Union and the United States, each, those of you that I hope have been reading Thucydides will see the whole thing in miniature in the Greek city-state system. The bigger the empire, the more nervous and fearful it is, lest any nibbling away on its periphery, any Angola, any Rhodesia, or on the other side, any breakaway by Czechoslovakia may be the beginning of the breakup of the empire. And in a sense, all the nations, but especially the great powers, are trapped by the existence of a world without law, without a world order, a world of anarchy, a kind of a jungle in which any power can make war and release perhaps the destruction of all mankind. In the absence of a world order, it's very hard to get rid of imperialist fears, imperialist machinations, and the problem of war, and with it the problem of the agencies. But it's a mistake to believe that this is the path of security. It's very interesting that in my lifetime, the three countries with the three greatest networks suffered the three greatest disasters. The Soviet Union, despite warnings from abroad, from Stafford Cripps, Churchill's emissary, and from an agent in Japan, that Hitler was going to attack the Soviet Union. Stalin was so sure, this man who didn't trust his closest comrades was always a sucker for the bourgeoisie, and especially for the fascists in Mussolini's time and later in Hitler's. He was so sure this was a permanent relationship that he didn't protect the border, he didn't heed the warnings. And in our own case, although we had a worldwide network of surveillance and we had agents up and down the China coast to watch the Japanese fleet, and even though the Japanese struck Manila about 12 hours before Pearl Harbor, most of our Pacific fleet was destroyed by a surprise attack. These were big surprises, and more recently there have been little surprises. When the Soviets invaded Czechoslovakia to crush the beginnings of socialism with the human face, just the way we intervened to crush socialism with the human face in Chile, President Johnson heard it first from the Soviet ambassador, and the CIA got it first from the Czech radio after the Russians grabbed it. There was surprise in the 73 attack on Israel for a very interesting, similar reason. We had so many means of surveillance through our satellites. We could register just about every camel sneeze in the Egyptian army. The sheer flood of intelligence information was so great that it took several weeks for the intelligence analysts to figure out that an attack was in the way. And on top of that was a nice easy preconception that Arabs couldn't be taken seriously as fighters. You know, a colleague of mine at American University told me he was invited over to CIA headquarters and taken into a room without windows and heavy hangings like this room and a great atmosphere of secrecy. And a CIA man in there showed him a lot of charts, and he said to him very proudly, "You know, we've been studying this problem for a long time, and we now are in a position to predict Pearl Harbor." So it undermines a free society. It runs counter to the intentions of the framers. It poisons human relations. It's a lot of damn nonsense. It costs millions of dollars more than it's worth. It puts us in the position of being a King Canute against social reform abroad. We need to keep on discussing it. We need to keep on fighting it. We need to honor the men who break away from it. We need to honor those who leak out the secrets to the press from time to time. We need to remain aware that it's still there. We need to continue to expose them, to keep this within bounds. And we need to make people realize that it's deeply bound up with our imperialist policy and with the lack of a world order on which the prevention of a new and catastrophic war and the prevention of a worldwide espionage of miasma really depends.
I.F. Stone, formerly the publisher of I.F. Stone's Weekly, speaking on the intelligence establishment at LaSalle College recently. Well, Terry, from I.F. Stone to John Dean, we've been coming to grips this afternoon with national security, the idea of national security and its abuses, and the political corruption that results from it, and the corruption of the people. And tomorrow we're going to bring the question of political corruption a little closer to home. The demise of the special prosecutor's office in Philadelphia looking into political corruption and graft has left many Philadelphians, to put it mildly, puzzled about why and what's going to happen. We're going to be hearing from three people tomorrow who directly and obliquely are talking about the problem of local political corruption and the special prosecutor's office. We'll hear Ed Rendell, who was formerly first assistant to Bernard Siegel, the special prosecutor, before the closing of that office a couple of weeks ago, from Jonathan Goldstein, whom we heard during the Dean interview, New Jersey's U.S. attorney, who is talking in general about the problem of political corruption, and from our U.S. attorney in southeastern Pennsylvania, Dave Marston, who has inherited the cases of the special prosecutor, and it's going to be mainly Dave Marston who's going to carry the ball in dealing with political corruption in the Philadelphia area, unless another special prosecutor is appointed at some time in the future. So those three will be talking on Fresh Air tomorrow.
And we'll be hearing that tomorrow at about 3 o'clock. So I hope you can join us then. Right now what we're going to hear on Fresh Air is Sonny Rollins on tenor saxophone playing a recording of The House I Live In. Thanks, Ralph.
This is Paul Spryrigan with Places for People. I really don't think of myself as being a sexist, which I understand is meaning biased against women, that is, if you're a man. But I know that I'm about to sound like one, because I'm going to talk about a certain kind of lady that frequents a certain kind of public meeting. A friend of mine in the government suggested a name for this type of lady. He calls them the sewer ladies. The sewer ladies are middle-aged, waspish, their kids grown up and away from home. They're well-spoken, they're lucid, and they're well-educated. The sewer ladies frequent public hearings on the subject of water and sewage. They're greatly concerned about the quality of drinking water, the thoroughness of sewage treatment, and about the state of natural waterways affected. The hearings are held whenever some public works project is announced, requiring an opportunity for the public to voice opinions, pro or con. The sewer ladies testify at these hearings, and they're quite impressive. They talk about coliform bacteria, biological oxygen demand, asbestos content, per capita water usage, population projections, and so on. They come to the meetings carrying armloads of technical reports. Their general stance is that current water or sewage treatment methods are not sufficiently safe, and because they're not safe, we should not enlarge them. They feel also that enlarging urban utility systems will cause already large cities to get bigger. Stop utility growth and you stop urban growth. Stop urban growth and more people will live in rural areas where the water is better because it's not polluted. The treatment there can be simpler, they think. So, if I understand them, they argue. Well, they may be right about the pollutants. It's fairly clear that environmental pollutants are the roots of the increase of cancer in our population. But I have great doubts about the prescriptions of the sewer ladies. For the consequences of not enlarging urban utility systems are just as serious as enlarging them, and in many cases, less conjectural. If urban water and sewage systems are not enlarged, then new and some replacement urban housing can't be built. The cost of housing increases, and so does the usage of obsolete buildings, including its plumbing. If we don't improve our current water and sewer networks, then we rely on existing systems, which, for the most part, are inadequate. Now that planning has coupled public facility development with urban development, we have one of the best tools ever for reshaping city form so that we can lessen its detrimental environmental impacts, even reduce them considerably, even transform them into environmental advantages. Also, if we don't build new and replacement housing, young families are denied appropriate places for child rearing, and that's a very serious thing for society as a whole. The sewer ladies' arguments, sadly, are usually poorly framed and incorrect, even though they sound very impressive, so much so that they really don't stand much of a chance. My bureaucrat friends who have to deal with them simply listen and go on with their business. The sad thing about the sewer ladies is that they could be much more helpful. It's not their fault that they aren't now. They only have bits of information, and they normally get their bits mixed up. Their problem is that they're only partly informed about the possible options open. They concentrate on one aspect of the environmental problem to the exclusion of other equally serious issues. Their concern for the health hazards of pollution is real and to be respected. But their approach is a waste of their time and loss of an opportunity in useful public dialogue. I fully respect the sewer ladies for their concern, but not their direction. They waste their powers and the public's time. This is Paul Spryrigan for National Public Radio.
This program was made possible with funds provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Thank you.
That was Wardell Gray, and you're listening to Fresh Air. This is WUHY-FM in Philadelphia. It's about 2 minutes to 4 o'clock now. Joining me in the studio now is May Rockland, who's the author of a book called The Jewish Yellow Pages. It's a mail-order catalog type of book. You don't have to mail away, of course, for anything, but it's kind of like a whole earth catalog of Jewish goods and services. There's a chapter on artists, for instance, which in many cases has photographs of their work. And these artists are people who are working in various media, but the work that they produce is related to Judaism. There's everything from that to where to buy good bagels and many other related items. May is also the author of a number of other books, including The Work of Our Hands, Jewish Needlecraft for Today, and The Hanukkah Book, which was published in 1975 by Schocken Books, and we'll also be speaking a little bit about the history of Hanukkah. May Shafter-Rockland now lives in New Jersey. She is a graphic and textile artist, and she's had several one-woman shows of her work in Madrid, Buenos Aires, and Minneapolis, and she's also a member of the American Crafts Council. You say, I think it's in the introduction to your book, May, that you kind of hope it to be something that can offer an alternative to tawdry traditional fare. And I thought maybe that's a good place to start by talking about what the tawdry stuff you're referring to is.
Well, let me just talk from my own experience. When I was newly married and my husband and I went to Japan, he was drafted into the Navy. I think it was the first naval draft since World War II. And there we were in Japan, and it was our first Passover. And my dear mother-in-law, who I'm very fond of, we've been married now 21 years, so she's been around a long time with us, sent me, to make sure that I'd have everything I needed for Passover, a matzah cover. and it was made of white satin, and it had sort of satiny, silky fringes and some gold and silver cord sewed onto it in what appeared to be a traditional design. And I had just finished school, and my training has been always as a craftsperson and as an artist, and I'd been working in ceramics, working in wood, and the satin, silvery, glittery thing had no relation to me as an artist or craftsperson, no relation to anything I felt about Passover. All I could think of it as was sort of a 20th century reproduction of a 19th century reproduction of a 17th century Baroque doodad, and it didn't relate to me at all. So I decided then, well, you know, and I'd use it because my mother-in-law had sent it, but that I would really make my own from then on. And that was, well, quite a while ago. It was about 19 years ago. And little by little, I began making more of the things that I wanted for our own Jewish holidays, simply because I couldn't find what I wanted in the stores, that, you know, things that were as nice or at least went with the rest of my lifestyle, which is something between, I don't know, antique-y, artsy, craftsy or something. But certainly the blue and brass patina things that we're familiar with from the usual Jewish Center gift shop things, the plastic dreidels, the over-ornamented religious items that don't, as far as I'm concerned, add any feeling of sanctity to the items. They offend me as an artist. They don't enhance my Jewish life. I can only say that in that they're traditional, they have a certain, I don't know, maybe a little gloss of nostalgia over them. That's the most I can say for them. So when I began to compile the Jewish Yellow Pages, I was very eager and then happy to find that there are many craftspeople and artists feeling as I do and who produce a wide variety of work in many different styles, some perhaps leaning towards the Baroque, but authentic, let's say, 20th century original Baroque or Ungepachkin, as we'd say, you know. And then, of course, the simple contemporary look.
There's, I think, a big identification, in spite of the tardiness of a lot of the Jewish items, from menorahs to small Bibles to dreidels, that I think people identify with somehow. For instance, if you're kind of brought up in a household, no matter what your religion or what culture it is, if the items are something different than handcrafted or something that purports to be authentic and is really, as you say, a copy of a copy of a copy, you know, it's difficult to really learn the difference, I think, for many people between what really is a meaningful craft and what is a kind of commercial replica, and to draw value judgments between them.
Maybe this was truer. There's the nostalgia kick. You know, if it's what I had when I was a kid, even if it's plastic or even if it's, you know, sort of schlocky, it's what I'm familiar with. But I think that today's Jews, there's a lot happening. Young people, let's say in their early 20s or late teens, many of them, well, they grew up with only gift shop reproductions, Reform Synagogue gift shop reproductions of Lower East Side, and that's, you know, it gets even further afield. And yet, they're all, with the help of things like the Whole Earth Catalog, turning back to the crafts. They're very interested in making everything for themselves and have, I think, a greater feel for it. Even your, let's say, typical suburban housewife whose idea of a craft project would be, let's say, a needlepoint kit, she's rather sophisticated. Even, let's say, her level of taste may be not beyond green stamp contemporary, but still, I think a lot of green stamp contemporary is better than what I would call tawdry traditional. So at least if we could raise the level of Judaica to that point. Also, I think people are really very responsive. What a kid wants at Hanukkah is a dreidel. Now, I think the response to, let's say, the redwood dreidels made by two California couples who really were fed up with the plastic dreidels that they could only find for their kids, and they took to their basement and they began making these really beautiful dreidlach out of redwood. And they sell them $3 for $5, which is, you know, they hand burn in the letters. I think anyone responds very positively to that. The form is traditional. Even the letters that they have burned in are the traditional kind of letters rather than a contemporary, let's say, Hebrew alphabet.
How did you find all these artists who you've included in your book?
Well, a lot of them I sort of accumulated over the years of friends and colleagues. We would be in one show or another together, and often these were not Jewish craft shows, but if they were doing anything Jewish or if they were Jewish, and I contacted them. And then the artists that I knew really over a number of years, because as I say, I've been doing it since about 1960, I've been working in graphics and textiles, ceramics too. I wrote to them, asked them for the names of their friends. Their friends had other friends, and it just began to circle out like a pebble in a pond with great radiating waves of water. And people then began to find me, which was very gratifying. And I sent them questionnaires asking for photographs, asking for samples if they could spare them. And people were very generous with their photos, slides, and work. Maybe the reason for their generosity was that I specified in my letter that the way they dealt with me, in a sense, would tell me how well I could expect them to treat the eventual reader of the book. Because my big fear is that I'll list someone and say, this person's really great, a wonderful craftsman, right, and all that. Then someone will write to them and say, hey, please send me, you know, a hand-done ketubah, and they'll never produce, or they'll never be willing to correspond about it, you know, and that would be just a waste.
Do most of the artists who you've listed there base all their work on Judaism, or if you know what I'm saying? For instance, the people who you refer to who make redwood dreidels, is all their crafts related to Judaism?
The only craft these redwood dreidel people are into are redwood and bronze dreidels. They are, in reality, one, the man is an engineer, and his wife, I believe, is a librarian. The other couple, I'm not sure what they do professionally. I think one of them teaches at Berkeley. I'm not really certain. But they only began the dreidlach out of frustration. And that's what they've been doing. They have a place, they now call it the Dreidel Factory. And it's, you know, it's a mini business, but it's doing very well. This is their third year, and they're making them and selling them. I did correspond with them and say, hey, you know, you guys are doing real well, and I like what you're doing. Why not go into other Jewish toys? Why don't you try even a new version of the Purim Grogger? And they were toying with that idea of doing more toys. I don't know whether they will or not. A lot of the other artists who are really full-time artists, rather than, let's say, these are what I would call cottage industry craftspeople, will work in Judaica some of the time. And then, like myself, I've participated in two bicentennial graphics productions as well, portfolios that we did, to honor the 10 crucial days, and then Princeton's involvement in the bicentennial. So I, you know, and I will work in any design area, but Jewish motifs are for me the most involving, because it best expresses totally who I am: Jewish, female, 20th century. Now it's who I am. Some of the artists do, I'd say, half Jewish work and half secular work. Some, on the other hand, like Ludwig Wolpert at the Jewish Museum, his work is totally involved with Judaic themes. Most of the calligraphers, I imagine, are totally into the Judaic themes.
How long has your art been centered on Judaism?
I'd say centered on Judaism for about the past 8 years. Yeah. In that, let's see, 8 years, yeah. 8 years. 9 years ago, I was 30, and I was coming back from Spain. We'd lived in Spain for 4 years, and I had been merrily doing lots of landscapes, etchings mainly of landscapes, and had a number of one-woman shows in Europe and South America. We lived in a number of places. I just had the last of my three children. A little girl. She was then 1 year old. We were sitting on the plane going back. It was my birthday, so it was just... My birthday was 2 days ago, so it was just 9 years ago. And I thought, okay, now everything is going to change. We're not going to live in Spain anymore. We're going back, you know, to home. I really want to see if I can't get my act together, both the female bit, the Jewish bit, everything into my new expression, because it's sort of time to change and identify. It didn't happen very easily because I was... I really was sort of ridden by the cliches that abound in Jewish art. And until you become very familiar with your techniques and also with the possibilities that Jewish art doesn't have to mean just a blue and white Star of David, you know, or some little curly lamb in the middle of a white ground or something. You can really express all sorts of thematic material and all sorts of joyous material. It takes a while, I think, to break through the cliches. And initially, I became very involved in doing a set of etchings dealing with Holocaust material. It was quite somber. And I read a lot of Elie Wiesel. In fact, he has a couple of my prints. And it turned me on tremendously. But I would get more and more morbid dealing with Holocaust material. And I began to feel that, wait a minute, I've always felt so happy about being Jewish. It was always just a turn-on. It's so pleasant and fun. And my Jewish childhood was very much a matter of this is what we do and enjoy rather than we can't write on Shabbos or we can't or we don't. I never thought of Judaism as a don't do, but more of a let's play kind of thing. And so after this whole Holocaust immersion, which was very good for me, very growing and learning to handle themes and visual imagery and so on, my work began to shift into a more, let's say, positive expression, a forward-looking and more playful thing. And also I began to work more in the crafts again.
It seems that you'd probably have a bit of a different relationship with your audience, both people who come to view your shows and who mm-hmm. are interested in purchasing work. On the one hand, perhaps maybe your audience is limited, i.e. limited to people who have an interest in Judaica. And two, on the mm-hmm. other hand, some people might buy your work just because it does relate to Judaism, and that's for them reason enough. Yeah. And from then, perhaps you wouldn't get the kind of feedback as to the specifics of your work that you'd get if it was, more abstract.
Yeah, I know just what you mean, though I've had some odd experiences that was sort of unsettling and taught me a great deal. I found that many Jews would come and see my work, both at shows or in the studio, and they would indeed be unsettled by the thematic material, and they'd say, really, I love it, May, but I can't live with that. Could you show me a landscape or, you know, a butterfly or something pretty? And, you know, I've always kept doing that. I like to do pretty things. I also did a set of prints dealing with, let's say, the feminist or woman's position. Those have always sold very well, too. So people would look at the more sort of astringent things and then buy the pretty things. On the other hand, many non-Jews have bought what I call the Holocaust material because, especially during the Cambodian and the Vietnamese periods and post that era, because when I work using Judaic themes, my feeling is that the Jewish message is really a universal one, in that whatever has happened to the Jewish people isn't, you know, it's just that we have been selected out to be pushed down or murdered or so on. It's sort of emblematic of what's happening in the world. And so when I did a painting, rather large one, called The Sky Is Their Cemetery, The Clouds Their Tombstones, for me, that meant the victims of the Holocaust who just vaporized into thin air. It was bought by Douglas College, by the senior class, for the library because, the senior class 2 years ago, because they felt that it really encompassed a lot of their feelings about what had happened to the Vietnamese and the Cambodian refugees, that they too just disappeared. And the imagery is really the same.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I see what you're saying.
Yeah.
Has it ever been hard for you to integrate your feminist beliefs with your Judaistic beliefs?
No.
You don't see a conflict there?
I don't see a conflict. And I think that's because, as my husband says, I'm so much of a feminist that I don't have time for feminism. And I can't become really dogmatic about it. I do what I want, and I don't allow things or positions to hold me back. Therefore, I can't be such a radical feminist that I would wish my three very marvelous and very definitely planned for children to be aborted at their present age. I mean, that's the very radical edge of feminism is,
well, I don't think they're necessarily related
right.
at all, really.
Well, they're not, and they are. I mean, if we're going to extremes, in the same way you have your very orthodox point of view of Judaism and your very orthodox point of view of feminism, well, yeah, you're going to have some kinds of conflict. But in that, I feel myself a feminist in terms of wanting and being able to do whatever it is that I want to do and not be held back, and equal pay for equal work, and, you know, just open opportunities and no special privileges, like, you know, being served first at a table and then last when it comes mm-hmm. to a job, you know, this kind of thing.
It seems that the Reform section of Judaism has made the most evident and tangible steps towards having equality within the synagogue and within the Jewish community. Can I ask you what type of Judaism you belong to and how you feel about the Reform movement?
Yeah, in my general keeping with everything else that I don't belong to, I'm basically non-affiliated.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel sometimes quite at home in an Orthodox synagogue, only sometimes, because there are times I really like the idea of being separated from the men. But that's only sometimes. Basically, I think I'm most at home in a conservative synagogue, which is, let's say, very open. Our conservative synagogue in Princeton allows and encourages women to read Torah, to have aliyahs, to be part of the minyan, to, in fact, fully participate in the ritual. And to me, this is really very fine. A friend of mine yesterday celebrated with her daughter her daughter's bat mitzvah, and this very beautiful girl read the whole Torah passage, conducted the entire service, and her mother descends from the line of Kohanim, or a high priest, and so her mother had the first aliyah, or call up to the Torah, and of course I like that tremendously. And what is it? It is very refreshing to realize that, you know, there are many, many women now studying for the rabbinate, and within 20 years we're going to have probably about 50% female rabbis in the United States. And it's going to take a while to get used to. It used to be the joke that a woman would go to rabbinical school only to meet a rabbi, right?
Right.
You know, like the reason for going to college is only meet a guy, right?
Yeah. But there'll be some changes, I guess.
Yeah, I hope so. I hope so.
We've kind of strayed from the topic
oh, right.
of the Jewish Yellow Pages.
Yeah.
I thought I'd bring up one point. Whenever any kind of ethnic heritage is in discussion, there always seems to be a kind of competition going on between who makes the best type of food specific to
right.
that culture. There's a lot of arguments, especially in New York City, I think, as to where the best pizza can be found, whether it's in Brooklyn
uh-huh.
or in Italy.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering, I know you have a section on food and specifically mm-hmm. on bagels. Yes?
Yeah.
Did you test taste them at all?
Well, I must admit to having had a fair number of lunches at Michelle's Deli in Princeton, mainly because I live in Princeton. I did test the other places, too, just because they're good. How can you walk into a place like that and not try something? It just smells so good. People have asked me about a number of other delicatessens, their favorites. You know, I say, well, what about, let's say, Zabar's in New York? And the problem with Zabar's is that it will not mail order. And it's very nice to list Zabar's, but if you're out, let's say, in Colorado and you're desperate for a piece of lox, well, Zabar's will mail order coffee, any kind. But
how can you mail order, though, bagels or lox or any kind of food that... you know, is perishable, and the bagels don't use preservatives in them.
Right. No, they'll pack things in dry ice and air freight them and guarantee that it will be there with the dry ice intact in 2 days.
No kidding.
Yeah, now,
must
you know,
be an
hopefully...
expensive bagel.
Oh, very expensive, really. I mean, when you're talking about lox and all these smoked fishes, it's expensive to begin with, so... I guess it's like, you know, having a lobster delivered packed in ice. I mean, people do that. I guess I'm lucky to live close enough to Michelle's to not have to do that.
Okay, if you're just tuning in now, I'm talking to May Shafter Rockland, who's the author of a book called The Jewish Yellow Pages, which is a guide to services and to artists and to food that is related to Judaism. We're going to change gears a bit now and talk a bit about Hanukkah, a holiday that we are now in the middle of, celebrated by the Jewish people. May has written a book called The Hanukkah Book, which is published by Shocken Books. I'd like to talk a bit about the history of the holiday. Can we go back to the beginning and get a straight story about it?
All right, I'll try for a straight story about it. Let's say roughly, well, in the second century before the Common Era, what we know now as Israel, Judea, was in the control of the Syrians. It's so somehow current that it makes me feel so current. You can almost follow the whole thing that happened on a current map right out of the newspaper. Israel was a passageway between Egypt and Syria, right along the coast. And the Syrians, led by Antiochus, the wicked king, wanted to establish a very monolithic and unified empire, including Judea. And in order to do that, and they wanted this really because one of the plans of Antiochus was to perhaps take on Egypt and really control an even larger area. And in order to fight abroad, he felt he needed a unified kingdom or empire behind him. To make this unified, he began to enforce the unity of peoples. Everybody had to be exactly alike, which meant worshiping the same gods, speaking the same language, wiping out all local differences. He was very successful in general. And in Jerusalem itself, which was a sophisticated capital, many Jews were so Hellenized that they could see no harm in going along with a lot of what he wanted. But he and, I guess, the Jerusalem... Jerusalem high priest didn't really count on the conservative nature of most of the Jewish population. What Antiochus did was he then proceeded to set up statues of himself in the synagogues and in the temple because, of course, he was God made manifest, and then people would worship him, and everybody who got to be king got to be God in those days in that kind of world. When he then, you know, many Jews then left Jerusalem, they really couldn't hack that and took to the hills. Among those who left was a family led by Mattathias, an old man, family we now call the Maccabees. It was really the Hasmonean family. And when, in fact, Antiochus began to set up more and more of these, let's say, statues, and insist that people would follow the Greco-Syrian rites of celebration in the small towns. They even followed Mattathias and his family into Modi'in, a small town outside of Jerusalem, not too far outside. And when they came to this town and were having, you know, their, let's say, their entry pageant and celebration, now here we are, and in honor of this big thing, we're going to sacrifice a pig on the statue, and we will all partake of this feast. And, you know, it's all this, this nice sort of homey festival. There was, in fact, a Jew who said, okay, we go along, they won't make trouble, we'll go up there, and he will eat of this pig. Well, Mattathias wouldn't stand for it, and he killed the Jew. At this point, all hell broke loose, and the Greek soldiers or the Syrian soldiers began slaying other people, and Mattathias and his crowd wiped out this small Greek contingent or Greco-Syrian contingent that had come down from Jerusalem to enforce the new rites. Once having wiped out this small force, they then, you know, realized at any minute the rest of the heavies would come down from Jerusalem. And so Mattathias said, anyone who is for the Lord, follow me. And the menfolk all took to the hills, and taking with them, well, some of the women, some of the children, and whatever farm implements they had to use as weapons. From that beginning, a guerrilla warfare began. It was basically a militia type of army, a citizen army. It was fed by the local people. So you had the guerrillas living in the mountains, and it was very much like, let's say, a Vietnamese or Cambodian type of thing, where they were sustained by the local population. The war, in fact, went on for 25 years until the last of Mattathias' son, Simon, did in fact live to see a united and free Judea. Again, he then was able to coin money and say Judea is a free country. This lasted precious few years until Rome came along and then gobbled it all up. In the first 3 years, however, the Maccabees did manage to retake the temple. When they retook the temple and cleansed it, they had a Chanukah, or dedication, ceremony. And they modeled that early, if you're interested in the history of the holiday, not just the history of the origins of it. This, in fact, is one of the only holidays that we really have an accurate historic account of its beginning. It was a military holiday. Well, when the Maccabees retook the temple, they found it a shambles, and it was quite, you know, it was just broken up. It had been used as a garrison. It had been used for athletic events, for all kinds of things. They cleaned it up, and they went to relight the lamp, the menorah, seven-branched lamp, which, in fact, was kindled daily and always stood. Now, the story is told, and, in fact, this story was made up several centuries after the actual rededication. The story is told that when they went to rekindle the lamp, there was only enough oil for one day, but it miraculously burnt for the 8 days that would be required to manufacture clean oil. Now, in reality, this is a lovely explanation for the fact that we light lights or candles during the Hanukkah period. Lighting the lights has nothing to do with the origins of Hanukkah, which, as I said, is a military thing. But the reality is, of course, that people have always been lighting fires in the middle of the winter, especially, well, all over the world, not just in the Middle East. We light lights in the middle of the winter because we're scared of the dark. It's cold, and maybe the sun won't really start to shine again. So if you light a light, it may bring back, reilluminate the sun. Apparently that worked, so people did it again and again. You know, they light bonfires, or all of our winter lighting celebrations, the Yule light, the Christmas tree lighting, all of them stem from these same very basic, very primitive feelings. And so when the Jews had to explain why they were lighting lights at this time, they said, well, there was a miracle of the oil. In reality, I like to think of this lighting the lights as, let's say, a poetic substitution. The miracle of survival can be represented in, and the miracle of religious freedom can now be represented in the lights.
How do you feel about menorah as symbol? Menorah as symbol that is used in many commercial institutions and stores, lobbies, to be placed alongside with Christmas tree as symbol or Santa Claus as symbol of a holiday.
In that sense, I don't like it. No, I really don't. The menorah is the oldest and most authentic Jewish symbol. It's based on the Tree of Life motif. It sort of combines a very earthly form and a heavenly kind of aspiration. And to stand it around and to begin to use it as a quick ornament and a commercial come-on, I don't like it. I don't like to see, I wouldn't like to see Hanukkah blown up into, let's say, as one of my reviewers called it, she said, Hanukkah is not just Christmas in drag. Well, I would hate to see Hanukkah inflated in such an artificial manner. It's a simple domestic holiday. It has greater meaning for us now than it had before, not only because of the push of Christmas, but because Israel has been reborn. I can't imagine the Jews in the ghettos of the 18th century or in the walled cities of the Middle Ages celebrating a military victory. I mean, can you imagine having a military parade, let's say? It would be, you know, an invitation for a pogrom. It's enough that we were having pogroms during Easter when theoretically, you know, we were turning Christian children into matzahs. I mean, why look for trouble? So, yeah, we would kindle the lamp in a very low-key kind of celebration, basically to say, we live, Israel still lives in this little light, you know, and you look at them, and all you're meant to do with these lights is really to look at them and remember that there's a past and there's a future, and that's it. And to then make it into a big brouhaha now commercially doesn't make any sense. But to have more zest for it, sure, because Israel's been reborn.
Okay, May, I want to thank you very much for joining us this afternoon on Fresh Air. I've been talking with May Shafter-Rockland, and we've been talking about basically two of her books and her own personal experiences. Her books that we've referred to are the Hanukkah book, which is published by Schocken Books and was published, I believe, last year.
Yeah.
And the Jewish Yellow Pages, which is her latest work, which, as I've been saying, is a kind of guide to various goods and services throughout the country that have to do with Judaism, from art to bagels and everything in between. That's also published by Schocken Books. I wish you the best, May, and thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me here.
You're listening to Fresh Air.
Each language only.
John Kirby from his album The Biggest Little Band. And before that, we heard Bamir Bustashane, which was done by Benny Goodman and his orchestra from a Carnegie Hall concert. You're listening to Fresh Air. This is WUHY-FM in Philadelphia. It's 20 minutes to 5 now. And in the studio with me is Fresh Air's film critic, Stuart Samuels. And over the weekend, we both saw King Kong, so we're going to devote this film segment to that great beast, the Kong before and the Kong after.
AK and, and BK, whatever. I didn't particularly like the new Kong.
I didn't like it either. And, I strongly disliked it.
Well, I mean, I can appreciate Dino De Laurentiis's intentions and what he tried to do. I feel he failed, and I want to sort of talk about that so much rather than just sort of criticizing the film for its silliness, because it is silly in a lot of ways. Just a couple of weeks ago, I was teaching the old King Kong to my class, and what struck me about the old King Kong versus the new King Kong was that the old King Kong is a real, authentic horror film. And what I mean by that is horror films, the audience is really the only one who knows what's going on. What draws people into a horror film is it plays on the audience's involvement. And no one in the film really understands the total dimensions of what all the characters are involved in.
That's a very good point. And usually a lot of the film is taken up with somebody trying to convince somebody else that there is a monster on the loose or is a strange, indescribable force that he knows nobody will believe, and indeed they don't.
Right, and we're the only one really can understand Kong's involvement with Fay Wray. Fay Wray can't. She's screaming all the time, and so there is no real understanding of that involvement with Kong in the old film. What the new film is, and De Laurentiis even says it himself, it is a love story. And it's a real, it's Eric Siegel revisited with Dino De Laurentiis, really is. In fact, the theater I saw it at, the next attraction is Eric Siegel's sequel to Love Story going to play there. So there's a real correlation there. And what I mean by it that it's a love story is that in this particular film, in King Kong, the old King Kong, Fay Wray, did not understand really the intentions of the ape. She's innocent to the end. She's innocent. She understands a little bit, but she's really frightened all to death about the whole thing. She's running continuously. In this film, Fay Wray's role is played by is taken by a character named Dawn, symbolically dressed in black as opposed to white, and it really means something because the new creature is not innocent at all. She is the supremely seductive sophisticate. She was found floating in a raft somewhere off a yacht in the middle of the Pacific, and there's a kind of seduction about her relationship to Kong that was not in the original. Not only does she understand what Kong is after, she plays with it. She tries to, and eventually she controls the ape. The difference between the Fay Wray woman and the new woman, Carol, I think Langley or whatever her name is that she really is aggressive. She's a modern woman in the sense of De Laurentiis' conception of a modern woman. She's aggressive. She's assertive. She's really the domineering individual.
But she's terribly stupid.
Well, she's stupid, yes, in a certain sense.
Who, if they had any smarts about them, would, when they are being held up by King Kong, and this is meant to be funny, mm-hmm. but it doesn't work, say, "Oh, Kong, put me down. I'm a Scorpio or Aquarius, whatever her sign was, and you know that means I'm afraid of heights." Now, if that's a line that is meant to be funny, it severely fails. If it's a line that's meant to reveal personality, what can it reveal except stupidity?
It's stupidity, but a certain sense of sophisticated seduction. I mean, I think I wouldn't identify the Dawn with a modern woman at all. I think it's a fiction. It's a caricature of what some of the traits of the liberation of women are sort of are being identified with: the aggressiveness, the assertiveness, the things that are positive in terms of that. But what this does is it ties it to seduction, it ties it to manipulation, because that's exactly what she does to this ape. Instead of what she does, she punches him in the nose at one point. She taunts him. She seduces him. At one point on the ship, she drops into his palm, and actually this giant 40-foot, 50-foot ape, she tells, "Be quiet. Sit in the corner. Relax. Don't let yourself bother." The ape is stupid. The ape is stupid. The ape is...
And in that sense, you think they're a couple that deserve each other. You think that they're the perfect match while you're watching
it. Well, the point is, it doesn't have any of the involvement we have the first one. The first King Kong was that here was this ape who all of a sudden was eroticized. The first King Kong was really a psychosexual fantasy. It played off on dreams, played off on the fears of the unknown, of the need, you know, the feelings of instinctual desire.
And of a very smoky, foggy landscape, right, that envelops the whole
dream landscape.
Film.
The landscape of going through the fog into the fog in this film is around the island, is not a wrong ship. The ship is in clear water. It's the island's in fog. It's exactly the opposite in the original film. It's everything else is in fog, and the island is really in the open, in this mysterious underworld. And the Kong's early version of Kong does battle with dinosaurs in this landscape of eroticism. Really, it's a landscape of phallic symbols, of deep chasms, of dreary, mysterious, dreamlike environment. This one, there's none of that. There's a beautiful scenery.
Yeah, it's kind
there's
of like lovely, a travelogue. Right, yeah. Lovely, come to the world of Kong. Yeah.
Come to Hawaii. Come to Maui. Live on the island. You know, live on the beach. And here, the old King Kong was a very smart ape. He wrestled. He punched. He outwitted the dinosaurs. He outwitted all of the activities. This one is so stupid and such a brute that he becomes really a putty in the hands of this sophisticated, smart, intelligent woman. So where Fay Wray was always innocent and always screaming, Dawn is sophisticated, super tough, and seductive. Now, what's absent in this film, I think, is really the psychological dimension. And what happens is that De Laurentiis sacrificed psychological involvement of the audience to a realistic presentation on the screen. Everything on that screen is done to the point where you start to believe the possibility of the involvement. The ape is so made so real in many cases. So much money was spent on making him so real that you start to, the relationship of his finger and his palm and the rest of his body to this woman becomes plausible, where it was not in the original one. In the original one, there was really a kind of way beyond any conception of reality. I wasn't even talking in terms of reality here.
I disagree a bit there, because I agree that the other one is not talking about reality, and that's why we can kind of accept it and really give ourselves to the film. But in this one, although Kong is very realistically made, technically, mm-hmm. the part that he's given and the facial expressions that he has to make and the kind of constant horny grunting that he has to go through is so unbelievable and then too ultimately boring that we get really tired of the characterization. And it's not quite realism. It's an attempt towards it that fails so badly that you're left with nothing because the psychological overtones don't exist.
Yeah, well, the realism becomes silly. In the old version, the mysteriousness became almost mythic, and that's what gave one's involvement, I think, and why that old one can be watched over and over again without losing any real excitement about it. In fact, you gain new insights into it. This one, you see it once and that's it. You see the special effects and you get involved in that. There's also another interesting element, I think, in with relationship to special effects and myth, and that this film seems to be saying, it has some very clever moments to it. It says that our myths have become our advertising slogans. This is where the old myths of the 30s were the myths of the fear of the unconscious, the instinctual, the life that was not really addressed and dealt with. We are a society that's lived our instinctual, unconscious needs out, at least in terms of public activity. We're very much concerned with making our instinctual desires public. Well, I think what happens is that idea of tapping into the instinctual and to the unconscious, particularly the sexual motif, which the original Kong done, was no longer plausible in this one. De Laurentiis was very much concerned with making another Jaws, and that he tried to do with this. But what he lacked, and what Jaws has, is Jaws has tapped into the element of fear. Kong has not tapped into any of those elements, and what it's done is really tried to put something over on the audience in terms of special effects, and what special effects are very much associated with is hype, sleight of hand. And the film was really a sleight of hand in many ways. The myths of, in fact, at one point in the movie it says, Esso has tiger in a have a tiger in your tank. We'll have a Kong in your car. You know, that is, we'll bring them back alive in order to increase our advertising slogan. So that De Laurentiis and the new King Kong, I think, are both an example and an embodiment of this kind of involvement that we have a society. McLuhan has talked about how our myths have really become slogans, and that both the film is a product of advertising hype, and the film is about advertising and not anything that really we have to fear. It's just an example of the way we've been duped, and the film is really an embodiment of that sense of being duped. A third element, which I found really interesting in this film, is that the initial King Kong was a conflict between the individual Kong, instinctual, versus the egomaniacal film director for the possession of the erotic object, being Fay Wray. And there was a conflict between Kong, modern civilization, for this object. In this one, there are very confused conflicts. You have a conflict between the intellectual paleontologist from Princeton, played by Jeff Bridges, versus the corporate executive from Petrox, who is the corporate side. So you have, one, in one sense, this conflict between the old conflict of students versus administrators, or hippies versus straight conformists. And there's some people have argued that the Petrox symbol is a pun for Pet Rocks, which was, again, an advertising slogan that people started to buy all these Pet Rocks, remember, last year? And it was like,
I don't remember that.
The Pet Rocks, everybody used to buy it for Christmas present, $5 rocks. It was just pieces of rocks in a box. And Pet Rocks was, the old Pet Rock concept is an advertising slogan. So that, in terms of the conflict, so that in one sense, the new King Kong is a dressed-up version of the student radical hippie turned now professor,
yes,
versus the conservative student now turned corporate executive.
Absolutely.
So you have one of those with bits of Vietnamese-linked dialogue in there, like, this island is full of natives that were taking away their birthright, they're bombing him, the helicopters that are all associated with Vietnam experience. But it's also a conflict between Kong, who has this desire for not sex. He's love. He's in love. Kong is not after sex as he was in the original one. He's after a love relationship. He wants to take her back and set up home with her. And the new Kong, he's lovesmith. He's like a freshman, a sophisticated, you know, sexy cultural, who's after a sexy cultural combination of a Sybil Shepherd, Ally McGraw, Marilyn Monroe, with tinges of Betty Davis in there. And he's sort of like, there's an element of this kind of lovesick freshman Kong sort of acting like that. And the film is turned about. It's no longer about instinctual drives and erotic desires. It's about sexual seduction and unrequited love, which is a very different sensibility than the earlier version. In the original, Kong strips Fay Wray, sniffs her, smells her on his lair. In this one, Kong bathes Dawn, the name, and literally blows dry her hair like he was a hairdresser. And there was some point in which Barbara Streisand very significantly wanted to play the role of Dawn, you know, in her relationship with her hairdresser friend. But nonetheless, there was a scene in there where he really becomes her servant, blow-drying her hair instead of really developing his erotic sensibilities that he had before her. So there was this really sort of interesting...
There's another connection. Element involved in that scene, I think. It's a kind of a hallmark of softcore porn to get a woman in tight-fitting clothes very wet and have her writhe around a bit, which she does within that scene where he puts her under the waterfall to wash off the petroleum that she's been rolling around in before when he dropped her down.
Yeah, but sort of what's interesting is that I don't know if many people know it, but there have been three versions of Kong. There was the original version, which was much more erotic, much more sexual, much more violent. Then in the 1940s, it was re-released again, where they cut out and released all the sexual and violent elements. So Kong became a kind of almost a nebbish, really, who was kind of taken advantage of by these this movie producer. And this one, so you have a movement from a kind of instinctual eroticism to a kind of censored censorship, a very straight old version, to a more romanticized love version. But one must say, in terms of positive aspects, the film does have really very good special effects. And the special effects in a good theater arrangement with stereophonic sound, I guess, would be worth to some people the price of admission. I'm sure that if Kong gets anything in terms of awards, it will get a special effects award
for
Hollywood.
It's only hope.
But there was a possibility of another help. As I was looking at the film and listening to it, it had the plausibility and the possibility of being high camp, of being another young Frankenstein, another Blazing Saddles. I mean, Mel Brooks, as the director of this, would have been a superb film. As it is, one of the writers, a man named Semple, is a very good camp writer. He wrote the Batman Robin series with a biff bang, very kind of fun. And some of his lines come through in this. Unfortunately, they're placed in very realistic dialogue or around realistic dialogue, so the humor really doesn't come out. I mean, individually, such lines as "You must be an Aries," which he says to Ape, is very funny. Or you male chauvinist ape. There's some very funny lines, but the way it's delivered, the context, you don't even want to laugh because it becomes silly rather than humorous. The sight of Kong, for example, encased in a giant Petrox gas pump at the end is very high camp. But again, the way it's handled, it loses all of that element of camp. So on one level, it had the possibility of being a very funny, humorous, satirical version of the old. And I think it would have worked at that level. This is a very confused film. And the confusion probably comes out best in the ending, where the hippie-turned-professor, Jeff Bridges, is cheering on Kong from one side of the World Trade Center as if he were a North Vietnamese soldier being attacked by American helicopters. I mean, you have this in one version. He says, "Go get him, Kong," as he takes one of the helicopters and throws it down. In the old version, Kong was against the rest of the world. There was no one on his side. There was no one who was there to cheer him on. We, the audience, were cheering him on in the old version. And everybody else in the film, including Fay Wray and all the other people, were really out to get him. So that gave us involvement. This one is none of that. You have the Jeff Bridges cheering him on. And Dawn, who understands it, telling him, "Don't put me down. Because if you put me down, they'll kill you." Again, sympathizing with Kong. So the sympathy that is presented on the screen and the support for Kong robs the audience of the sadness of the original ending, of feeling they're sad for us, so why should we be sad? Why should we get tears in our eyes for this animal being destroyed? And the old one, he really was a mythic creature turned human. And the sympathy we have for the old one was that we understand his desire to be human, to gratify his instinctual needs, to identify with his plight. We understand that. In the new King Kong, he's larger than life. He's turned docile. He's a male chauvinist ape who's become, domesticated, who in the end, really is not alone against the rest of the world, but is part of that kind of arrangement with two of them cheering him on against the helicopters. We're just asked to cheer on at the end. In the end, the new King Kong, instead of becoming real, becomes symbolic. He becomes symbolic, and that's why I don't think we have any involvement with him. He becomes a symbol of all the natural environments that were raped by the capitalist corporate structure. He's become symbolic of all those student radicals who were seduced by corporate funds in the 70s. He becomes symbolic of all the small islands and nations that were brutalized by civilization because at the end the helicopters armed with machine guns tear them apart. And he becomes symbolic of the sexually impotent images of other films like Bonnie and Clyde and Sonny and Godfather and Kong. All three of them have the same thing done with them, and then they're riddled with bullets and blood gushing from all this. All of them are the same. And all of them, so that in the end, he is destroyed symbolically. He no longer has the kind of human element that we identify with the old King Kong. And in the end, what is successful is really the corrupt social order, who sort of wins out, and Petrox and Kong is lost, and Dawn is lost in the middle of. They all are separate at the end. They try to get to each other, but the crowd prevents Dawn from getting to her new boyfriend, the paleontologist professor, and Kong's lying in the street. So there really isn't any coming together for the audience to leave the theater either up, saddened, or moved. Instead, they're left with a certain empty feeling.
I was left with an empty feeling. I was bored through a lot of it and sorely disappointed. I'm sure there will be a lot of people listening who will not be able to keep themselves away from Kong film one way or the other, an emotion which I can sincerely understand.
It'll make its money back.
Right. Yeah. Well, certainly a lot of money paid. Maybe that's something we should be talking about another time, the amount of money spent on a film like Kong with the kinds of results, Stuart, that you have been talking about. Thanks a lot, Stuart. Some very interesting comments about the new King Kong. That's about it for Fresh Air this afternoon. My name's Terry Gross. I want to thank you very much for listening and wish you a very good evening. Technical director for today's show has been Jerry Womer. Ralph Flood contributed to today's program. Hope you can join us tomorrow afternoon. We have about enough time here for about three notes from the original King Kong soundtrack.
This is listener-supported public radio, WUHY-FM in Philadelphia.
From National Public Radio in Washington, this is Bob Edwards.
And I'm Susan Stamberg, with All Things Considered.
Eleanor Roosevelt told of her secretary who had walked past the Lincoln bedroom and spotted the president sitting on the bed, pulling on his boots. So Lincoln has been there for quite some time.
Ghosts in the White House? Definitely, according to reporter John Alexander. Tonight on All Things Considered, the author of Washington's most famous ghost stories warns the Carters about things that go bump in the night.
President-elect Carter made more cabinet appointments today, and in the course of it ran into the ghost of Harold Carswell. Bob Berglund will be Secretary of Agriculture. Juanita Kreps heads the Commerce Department.